Galatians chapter 1, starting at verse number 11. This is Paul writing to the churches in the Galatian region. He says, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that the gospel I preach is not of human origin. I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it. Rather, I received it by revelation from Jesus Christ. For you have heard of my previous way of life in Judaism, how intensely I persecuted the church of God and tried to destroy it. I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people and was extremely zealous for the traditions of my fathers. But when God, who set me apart from my mother's womb and called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles, my immediate response was not to consult my human being. I did not go up to Jerusalem to see those who were apostles before I was, but I went into Arabia. Later, I returned to Damascus. Then, after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to get acquainted with Cephas and stayed with him 15 days. I saw none of the other apostles, only James, the Lord's brother. I assure you before God that what I am writing is writing to you is no lie. Then I went to Syria and Cilicia. I was personally unknown to the churches of Judea that are in Christ. They only heard the report. The man who formerly persecuted us is now preaching the faith he once tried to destroy. And they praised God because of me. I want to instigate transformation. I lost a childhood friend a couple of years ago, Terrence, who we called Boo-Boo. Boo-Boo was always at the center of trouble. Whether it was convincing me, and I've shared this story, to light a large pile of leaves on fire for only for me to watch there in terror while he runs away, or whether it was him standing in the middle of two kids, two friends arguing or quarreling over something, and his sole purpose in being and inserting himself in the middle of an argument was to escalate it. Boo-Boo was there instigating. Oh, he said this about you. Oh, he said this about you. And that was his sole purpose, so that the words would eventually come to blows. He was always instigating fights. He took great joy in watching others fight. And when I tell you he was good at it, he was good at it. Every fight that took place on our street, Herman Street, in Buffalo, New York, Boo-Boo was right there in the center of every fight. He was an instigator. How many people here know any instigators in your life? It might be a sibling or two, might be a brother, a sister, something like that. Instigating typically has a negative connotation, but in the realm of our discussion about transformation, I urge you to consider it in a positive light. You see, we have expressed our longing for transformation, lay out our lives before God to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. That's worship. We get that from Romans 12. We have also been encouraged to welcome transformation. It's not enough to simply desire or long for transformation. When God enters our life and is prepared to transform, we have to welcome that, not fight it, but to welcome that. But now we've come to a place where we are living in the transformative power of Jesus Christ. And now that we have longed for it, now that we have welcomed it, we ask that simple question, well, now what? Herein lies the mission of God. As those created in the image of God, it is now our calling, just as it was the calling of the Apostle Paul, to instigate transformation in others. Paul was called to preach the gospel in the world. Before he could preach the transformative power of the gospel, he had to first experience the gospel and the transformative power of the gospel in his own life. There is no doubt that Paul is one of the most influential figures in the Christian faith. We have preserved for us many of his writings, not all of them, but many. The book of Acts serves as a biographical sketch of the ministry and life and faith and travels of Paul the Apostle, who was formerly known as Saul, the persecutor of the church. And much of what we practice in our expression of Christian faith originated with the teachings of Paul. But I would argue that the most important contribution that Paul has made to the Christian church was his story. In terms of theology, we might say Paul was an expert. That's fair. It's probably pretty accurate. But I would argue that his storytelling, particularly the retelling of his own story, was one of his biggest rhetorical contributions to our Christian faith. In various settings, in an effort to explain the power of God through Jesus Christ, Paul simply told his story. His story of transformation is one that demonstrates to us what can happen when the power of God is in control of our lives. It's when we give up control. It's when we declare Jesus Christ as Lord. When we give that up, Paul's story shows us what transformative power can do. Paul's story has provided an impetus for the transformation stories of so many. And that's why I have been so insistent for a long time in our body that we know our own stories and that we rehearse our own stories and that we tell our own stories. The purpose of our storytelling is not to bring attention to ourselves. It's not to focus on our lives, but it's to bring attention to the power of God. The function of stories in the Bible is not to bring focus to the characters themselves, but to the character of God and his story. Newsflash, the Bible is not really about us. It's about God. And the small stories that we see throughout, from Genesis through Revelation, it's not about those characters. The characters, they play an important role, but those characters play the role of helping the reader to identify who God is. Telling our stories is a way of telling God's story. In fact, I really don't want to spend a lot of time up here preaching this morning. I want you to listen to a story. It's a story of someone who is a part of this body. A couple weeks ago, this individual shared with me that they were coming up on a major milestone. Six years. How many people remember what happened 6 years ago? This person remembers what happened 6 years ago on February 22nd. Because on February 22nd, this person started out on a journey of sobriety. And on February 22nd, this person is gladly celebrating 6 years of sobriety from alcohol and drugs. And I just want you to hear this person's compelling story, because it is an example of transformation. And it's an example of when you are transformed, you are then moved into a place of instigating transformation. So this morning, I want us to hang out with Mr. Cooper. Joe Cooper, come tell your story, brother.
Thank you, Dion. Yeah, just thank you so much, Dion. You are great. Like, one of the first times I came here, you even quoted a rapper saying, "Mo money, mo problems." And like, it won me over when you said that, because through you, I've learned that you can be human and still a man of God. Like, a lot of churches and stuff put an emphasis on you have to be perfect in every aspect of your life. And I feel like that's too much for me. Like, I feel like I'm setting myself up for failure if I strive for perfection. I believe in progress, not perfection. And I've learned that through Alcoholics Anonymous, is spiritual progress, not perfection. Transformation, by definition, is a change in your physical appearance, which I like to do that quite often, whether I'm running, whether I'm lifting. I'm trying to always change, or facial hair, whatever. I've been growing this since No Shave November. This is all I got because I can't grow it here or here. So it works. That's by definition what it is. But Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual process, and it's getting in touch with your higher power, whether that be God, Buddha, or whatever it is. Mine's God. And, you know, all of our stories are different, but we all have the God in common, you know, and that's why I like it here. But spiritual transformation usually consists of three major things, which would be fellowship, which we all do here, prayer, or disciplines such as prayer, and counseling. You know, whether I'm having a problem or something, and I'm a person that you can read how I'm feeling. People say, "Hey, what's wrong?" And we'll sit there in the back, me and Jason's done it, me and Kent's done it, and we'll talk about stuff going on in my life, or they'll share a story of theirs with me, and it makes me feel better. Even Bill over here, I like Bill, I like talking to Bill. But I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor. A sponsor is somebody that you call when you're having trouble, or a sponsor's main thing is to work you through the steps. And I sponsor people now, but in order to get there, you have to work the steps yourself. God brought me to AA, and AA brought me back to God. For a long time in my life, I had lost my relationship with God because I was mad. I was mad, like, why did you do this to me? Why did you do that to me? Why is my life going the way it is? So let me tell you my story. When we were all five, when I was five, I'll say it for me. When I was five, I had this blueprint. I do construction work, so this makes sense, just to use blueprints and stuff. I have this blueprint of how I want my plan of my life to be. Well, stuff happens. You know what I mean? Life happens. And stuff changes. And you know, when I was five, my blueprint was have a mom, have a dad. You know, everything's going great. You know, my dad works on the cars, does the lawn. My mom cleans and cooks, you know what I mean? And life is pretty good. I got an older brother, older sister, play sports, go out and have fun, go on vacations. And then 2 days before Christmas, when I was 5 years old, my dad died. My dad had a heart attack. I run into the bedroom, and I remember saying, Dad, holding his hand, saying, "Dad, wake up. Dad, wake up." Never woke back up. And you know, for a long time, where I was so young, I didn't really understand what happened, and it didn't affect me until later in my life. You know, so growing up, I kind of stuck with the older kids because I looked for guidance. My mom is a great woman, great Christian woman. You know, went back to school, did really well, made the dean's list and stuff, did really well for herself, became like a politician back home. And I'm really proud of her. But when you have three kids, it's hard to keep your eye on everybody. So I would look to my older brother, my older sister, and their friends for guidance, which if they're 5 and 7 years older than you, you're probably not going to be getting the best advice. Now, some things are going to be good advice and good to be around, but a lot of things aren't going to be the best. So I started at an early age of drinking on the weekends because I thought that's what you do when you got older. You know what I mean? You drink and you have fun. So I would see about sixth grade, which I look at a sixth grader now, I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was doing that. Like, me and my friends would go camp out in the backyard and we would drink every weekend. And what I have, the disease of alcoholism, it is a mental obsession. So I mentally obsess about all through the week, mow grass, do something, do whatever to get money so I can buy alcohol. You know, and for me, you know, you hear marijuana is the gateway and all this. For me, alcohol is the gateway. So once I drink alcohol, and that's why I call myself an alcoholic, because everything starts with that first drink. Once I take that first drink, I'm doing whatever it takes to not have my feelings. You know, today I deal with my feelings, which is a lot different than what I used to do. Going on up in, you know, junior high, I started messing around with marijuana, started smoking weed, and, you know, I would blend in with the crowds. You know, I was a chameleon. I could blend in with this crowd, and I can blend in with the sports crowd. I can blend in with this, you know. In school, I was an all-A student. I played every sport, every major sport. I played football, basketball, and baseball. And, you know, I was just pretty good kid. Nobody knew that behind the scenes I was doing all this stuff because I excelled at everything. So it was real hard to see that I had a problem. In high school, where my brother and sister were older, they were all in college, and college years, most people will start partying. So that's who my friends were. That's who I hung out with. And I was partying all the time. I think, you know, a lot of people might be like, where's the mom at and all this, but, you know, kids have a funny way of hiding things. You know, kids can definitely hide things if they want to. And I did that. And my sophomore to junior year in the summertime, I was at a party. I had, I can't remember the day, but I get kind of mixed feelings from the party the week before. I knew where I was at, but this kid asked me if I wanted to ride home with him, and I said no. I made the decision right there, you know, life's full of choices, you know. And that blueprint's going to change all the time. Every choice you make, that blueprint is going to change to how it's supposed to be built. In the trades, we call it the as-built drawings. So you have your idea, which the engineers give you, and then you have your as-built drawings, which is the way it's actually designed. So I told that kid, I said, look, you know, we get in trouble every time we hang out together. So I don't want to go with you. And I ended up going with my buddy that I played sports with. We was going 80 miles an hour out of a road that should be only traveled probably 35 miles an hour. Went off one side of the road, came across the other, hit a metal culvert. A culvert's like a big metal tube that goes through the ground to take water across. The car did one flip in the air and six or seven on the ground end over end. I was ejected 40 yards from it. I hit the ground with so much force it caused my sternum to break, 8 ribs, collapsed my lungs, messed up my shoulder, and I had a TBI, which is a traumatic brain injury. I wake up 2 weeks later out of a drug-induced coma. They used fentanyl to put me in a drug-induced coma, which fentanyl is what, when you heard the news about all these people ODing and stuff, that's what their drugs were laced with. It's a really powerful drug. I was in a coma with it for that long. And then 2 weeks of intensive care. When they got ready to move me to Children's, they had to teach me how to walk again because of my head injury. I had to learn how to, you know, put stuff, and, you know, my muscles hadn't been moving. So, and before that, I was in the shape of my life. Football conditioning was the week before that accident happened. So I was in probably the best shape of my life. And it's really, when I reflect on it, it's like, wow, look how far I've came. And, you know, that for that, when I got out of Children's and all that, for all the back school rehab, because when you have a head injury, they have to test you for everything that could go wrong. But the only thing that was affected was my memory and my eyesight. So they released me. You know, counselors would ask me if I had a problem with drugs and alcohol, which I'm sure they did the toxicology report and found a lot of bad things in my system. And I denied it. I was like, I don't have a problem at all. You know, I don't talk to counselors, so. I made it out, and you know, I'd go to school for half days because I'd be tired all the time. I was just wore out all the time. And my mental obsession began to pick up because I had untreated alcoholism. I didn't know that I had a problem. And so my mental obsession, I started dreaming about smoking weed. And I was like, well, my lungs are damaged. You know, they said they looked like Swiss cheese. Oh, and I flatlined 5 times. When I went to the hospital, they brought me back to life 5 times. Like, so it was real eye-opening.
Like, oh, I died.
You know, like my dad was with me. I'm a firm believer in angels, and that's actually what brought me back to God. Like, if I can believe in angels, then I definitely believe in God. Sorry, little side note. I kind of jump around a lot. My mind races like 100 miles an hour in a 35-minute-hour lane. It's always racing. So anyway, I forgot where I was, sorry. Happens. But I'd started obsessing about it, and I was like, you know what? I can't smoke, but I could make brownies. Such a stupid idea. So I did that, and that night I ended up smoking. That's how my phenomenon, they call it in the big book, they call it the phenomenon of craving. Once I had that one, I was right on to the next. And you know, that was about the time that Oxycontins really took off. And somebody had offered me one at school and I did it. All my pains in my body went away. I felt normal again, and it was a great feeling. And after that, it was just all downhill, you know. My senior year, you know, everything was still going well, you know what I mean? After my junior year, you know, I started to get all a little bit of my coordination back and stuff. I started playing football, you know. Grades started picking back up, you know. It was a little bit tougher, you know. I had to write down stuff before I went to bed so I'd remember it when I woke up. Like, there were still some difficulties, but, you know, for the most part, the school took it easy on me because of that. And I would be in these classes where I didn't really have to study because I already knew what they were talking about. They put me in like the easy math classes and all that. And I was already so far ahead that I could do all that stuff. And, you know, I finished school. I finished National Honor Society. I you know what I mean? And the fall homecoming, I was a homecoming king. You know what I mean? I was popular and everything was going well. But there was that hidden thing of me doing drugs in the background nobody knew about again. The pills really grabbed a hold of me. And when I turned 18, I received $150,000 from that car wreck, which I had signed over to my mom because I thought that was the only way I could get that money. And I held a lot of resentments against my mom. I felt like she tricked me into signing those papers. So I would find ways of getting that money from her. Because it's my money, it's not her money. So I would find ways of getting that money. I would, I don't know if I should tell you this. I went to a 2-year college for 6 years, no degrees. But I would go and I would sign up for like 15 credit hours and then I would drop all the classes so I could get all the money. And I would keep like one or two that I liked the professors in, which I would do really good in them classes, but... But so I'm really close to having 2 degrees. But that eventually ended, you know. Eventually I just quit going. Eventually I quit working my jobs. I didn't care. I had started taking this medication that made me not care about anything. I got with this girl, which that was her thing, and we were codependent. I was codependent on her when she had her medications, and she was codependent on me when I had my medications. So it was an unhealthy relationship, and I had hit a bottom where I wasn't going to end my life, but I didn't care if it ended. You know what I mean? I was at that point in my life where I just didn't care. I was like, you know what? If my life ends today, I ain't going to be mad. But I wasn't going to do it. I was, funny story, the unlike this part of my story. My moment of clarity, I'm setting, it's 4 a.m. I don't have any medications. I'm shaking, I'm cold sweating, and you know, I'm like convulsing almost because I don't have my medications because I was on the heavy dose of benzodiazepines, which is like a Xanax and stuff like that, which is one of the hardest drugs to come off of. So I'm sitting there shaking and thinking about what I can do and watching the TV, sitting in the chair, and I'm the only one home, and Richard Simmons' Sweating to the 80s comes on. This is my moment of clarity. I am sitting there and I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy is happy? Everybody around him's happy? I'm sitting here shaking, can't control my bodily functions, and he's jumping around like a cat from a tree. I know, that's crazy, Dion got me. He told me not to look, but I had to. So that was my moment of clarity. 6 a.m, I called my mom to come get me. She came and got me. I went up to my mom's house, and she called my family doctor and asked for help on where I need to go and stuff. And I didn't have insurance or anything, so my mom paid for my rehab, which is really expensive. So God bless her. You know, I thank her so much every day for that. And I went up there for 2 days before I could get into treatment in Gahanna at Parkside. I went there for 26 long days. Every day, they said every day it gets better, and every day I was like, it don't get better. I was like, I feel worse every day. I was on some heavy narcotics. So every day it seemed to feel different problems every day. So I eventually got pulled into my counselor's office. It looked like Jerry Garcia, by the way. It's kind of awkward. He said, so, you ever thought about sober living? And I'm like, a halfway house? No, I'm too good for that. Sorry, I didn't say it like that, but I thought that. And he's like, well, your mom and stepdad don't want you coming back home. I was like, well, since it's the only option on the table, I guess I'll check it out. So I went there, and you guys hear about summer rays here all the time. And you guys didn't know I lived there for 2 years when I started coming here. I didn't really disclose that because, you know, nobody asked me. If you asked, I'd have told you. But it really showed me that, you know, rehab helped me get some tools to learn how to be sober. But summer rays showed me that I could live life sober, that I could have fun in sobriety, that I could play basketball again, that I could start running and training again. I actually started training at one of the houses up there by his cafe. I started running in the backyard, and I marked it out where 6 laps around the 2 houses was 6 miles. And I lost 35 pounds that summer, just training and stuff, but really hard training because I'd go hard at everything I do. That's kind of the alcohol. Like, my alcoholism is good if I put it to good use. I mean, because I'm obsessive about stuff. So I just have to keep in mind on healthy things. So, you know, I lived there for 2 years and I learned a lot and I've seen a lot of people try it. I've seen a lot of people try to drink. And every time they drank, they would end up going to what they loved, whether it be pills or heroin or cocaine, whatever. But every time they took that first drink, it was right off to the races. So they did the research for me so I don't have to. You know what I mean? When I would see that, like, I'd be like, wow, that's what could happen if I did do it. And I never seen anybody that was able to do it once you cross that line. And I crossed that line, so I just never tried it again and haven't so far. You know, now life is pretty amazing. You know, I worked at Home Depot the first year. And living there, you have to go to an hour church every week. So I would come here on my break from Home Depot. I don't know if you guys remember that, but I would come here on my break from Home Depot, and then I would go right back to work. I got fed up with that job. I got tired of that job and how they treated me. And I started looking elsewhere. My buddy was an iron worker, and I was like, you know, that's pretty cool. You know, you get free schooling, and you learn trade. I was like, it's pretty cool. So I got online and started doing, started looking at Monster and stuff, and I filled out this thing, and it said I'd probably want to look into a union sheet metal worker. I looked into it. I took the test. You know, they have like a mechanical amplitude test, or however they say that. It's a mechanical test, you know, math and writing and then the interview. And I got into the four-year apprenticeship, which is you go to school 3 months a year for 3 days a week, and you work full-time. So, I mean, it's a very busy life, you know, because you're working through the day, and then at night you're doing math, you're doing welding, you're doing technical drawing and stuff like that, which it's a lot on your plate, but, you know, I just recently finished that, and it's really a blessing, you know. In that apprenticeship, I worked mostly at the James Cancer Hospital. So that I consider that my baby. That's my baby because I got there when there was only 7 floors. And now it's a massive building. And I know that building probably better than anybody that works there. Because I worked there for so long, I worked floors. I wasn't on just one. Because a lot of people were just on one floor. I did what's called a punch list. I would go through and fix problems on every floor. I'd go around my little cart, and people hated when they see me. They're like, oh, no, what's wrong with my floor? So whatever. But I just recently, actually, in my schooling, I added an additional day at the end for fire life safety. Which fire life safety is, in a big building, you have your ducts that go through the walls, and they shut down in case of a fire event. And I had to go through and make sure everything's shutting down right. So therefore, I had the opportunity to run a job there. So I was in charge of a job there for my company, which is a pretty big deal. And then I just ran one at Daly Road Medical Center, and I'm currently running one at Doctors West, which is a mess. And it's a lot of stress. It's a lot more than just working. Like, going to work's one thing, but when you're in charge of stuff, it's like, it's a whole other animal. But it's truly a blessing to see where I had been, you know, what I had to go through, and where I am now. Like, it's unbelievable. In sobriety, I've won 3 5Ks. And that's hard to believe, considering I wasn't breathing on my own. I had to learn how to walk again. And that's just truly a miracle. You know, how much our bodies can come back, and how much, if you put forth the effort, how much you can change, you know, with a few good decisions. I don't have it memorized, but I know when I found my home church is Dion had said Jeremiah 29:11. You know, it's about seeking God. I can't quote it, but if you know that verse, it's a really good verse. Maybe Dion can help me out here in a minute. But it really opened my eyes to, you know, that I need to stay and I need to remain calm, and good things are going to happen, you know, if I put my trust in God. And it's hard for me to trust people. And I trust Dion. I trust Bill. I trust Kent. You know what I mean? There's many others I trust, but I'm just pointing out a few people. But I just want to thank you for letting me share my story, and I hope somebody got something out of this. Thank you.
Cool. Now stay there. Yeah. Look at this, man. It's your family, man. See? Yeah. All right. Cool. Cool. Just a couple things in closing that I want you to know, particularly as we talk about this idea of instigating transformation. So talk about what you do on Thursdays.
See, I knew I'd missed something.
Is that
glad he came up here. So Thursdays, when I went to rehab, first, let me hit you with this, because I know you said to bring this up. When I went to rehab, I rode in the back of my mom's car with my niece, and she held my hand the whole time and kept saying, Uncle Joe, it's going to be okay. My hands were sweaty like I just put them in a water bucket, and she kept telling me, she said, Uncle Joe, it's going to be okay. And I just remember that so distinctly. It was the longest car ride of my life. But every Thursday, I go back to that rehab. Like people that are friends with me on Facebook, you see me post the city barbecue. I got free city barbecue, which they usually give me free. They just like me there. I can't explain. I'm gonna be honest, I give them tips, and I don't think a lot of people give them tips, and I give them good tips. Like, they come by and check on me or whatever. I always sit by myself. They come by and check on me, I'll give them a really good tip. And, you know, sometimes I'll go in there and they're like, here, it's on the house tonight. And I'm like, thank you. So then I post it on Facebook and say, wow, just got some free food. And everybody's like, how do you do that? Well, I mean, you got to put into it, you know what I mean? But anyway, every Thursday, that's my thing. I go there every Thursday. Then afterwards, I go to that rehab and I talk to people on detox. Detox is people who are on medication still to help them get over the withdrawal symptoms. There's an AA meeting downstairs, which I did for probably 2.5 years. I was the chairperson and the secretary, meaning I pick who talks, as in it's a lead meeting, so it's somebody gets up and talks for 45 minutes. I would pick who talks, and I would take care of all of, like, the buying the books, the chips, and all that. So I did that for 2.5 years. Now I go back and I talk to the detox. I go up on the floor where the patients have to stay up there, and I go and we talk about the first step. The first step of Alcoholics Anonymous is admitted we were powerless over drugs and alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. And I tell them a little bit about my story, and then we just go around the room and I kind of help them reflect on, you know, maybe you probably shouldn't go back home because it don't sound like a safe environment, or, you know, maybe you need to change your job, or, you know what I mean? I give some outside perspective because, you know, with a little bit of perspective, you can learn a lot. Mm-hmm. And I recently read a book called The Noticer, and I love it. It's about perspective. So if you've ever read that book, it's great. Well, sorry, cool. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. No. So did you see that he had that moment of clarity with Richard Simmons? and this first step in AA, that's sort of that longing for transformation. That's admitting that you're powerless. That's laying yourself at the altar saying, I want change. But then there's these choices that you have to make. And during these choices that we make in this process of transformation, we don't do that by ourselves. We do that in community. And thus we have a niece that's holding a hand that says, it's gonna be okay, Uncle Joe. And then once he goes through all these wonderful, times of transformation, and you can see if you've known him since the first time he's come here, I mean, this dude is getting buffer and everything else, and all that. But he can't hold in his story of transformation. And so what he does then is share this story, not only on Thursday nights, but with whomever would be willing to listen to his story. Let's bring it back to Paul as we close this morning. You know, Paul was one who, because he had this incredible experience where God changed him and transformed him from a killer of the church to a participant of the church, he could not hold it in. He tells this story that I read in Galatians several times, is recorded in the book of Acts. And in chapter 26, there's a part where he's talking to King Agrippa, and he tells this old story, and it's longer there. And at the end of the story, the king, Agrippa, says to Paul in Acts 26 and 28, he says, do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? And then Paul replied, short time or long, I pray to God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for these chains. He told his story as a way to instigate transformation. I just want to take a second to thank you, brother, for being brave enough to share your story in front of your family. This is your family, and we thank you for blessing us with your story, my man. All right, man. And Joe's not the only one in here. I know that several of you in here have stories, and you've blessed me with the opportunity to sit and listen to your story. And as much as we were blessed with the listening of Joe's story and the listening of each other's stories, church, we've got a story to tell in our neighborhoods, in our communities, at our jobs, in our schools. The reason that we are participating in and trying to partner with Slate Reed Elementary isn't so that we can check something on our resume and say, yeah, we helped out in a school. No, it's so that we will in some way instigate transformation. That's the call of God for each and every one of us. It's the call of God for the church. That's the message for you. I pray that you receive that. And I pray that you are blessed by Joe. And I want you to know, this is how the Spirit works. I didn't go to Joe. I was in the process of putting this series together. And Joe came to me and said, you know what? I think I want to share my story. And immediately I attached with, man, I know what the third sermon is going to be about, and I know who's going to deliver the majority of it. You are, and that's why he was sweating so much this morning. But thank you again. And anyone here, you're always welcome to share your story. We have to share these stories. I think telling our stories here, that's what it means to rehearse our stories. We rehearse it here with people we love, and we know people are going to be kind to us and not going to give us too much flack for that. We rehearse it here, and then we go out in the community and we tell our stories. Is that all right, church? I pray that there was something said that has provoked you to take a deeper look at your story, to get you to participate in rehearsing your story and to eventually tell your story. As we sing this song right now, if there's something that we can do for you as a church through prayer or to help you navigate through your transformational process, I don't know where you're at. Maybe you're at the welcoming stage. Maybe you're at the longing stage. Maybe you're at the instigation stage. Wherever you would like us to join with you in your process of transformation, we would love to be a church that will love you through that process. So let's stand and let's sing this wonderful song about transformation.